Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
It's late night in London and we're recording an emergency episode of Americast with the news that Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 charges. We're going to be talking about what this means for Trump, for the Democrats and Republicans, and how it shifts the state of play for the 2024 election. You can hear all of the analysis on Americast. Just search for it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 6th of April, these are our main stories. Taiwan's president has met the Speaker of the US House of Representatives in California, despite threats of retaliation from China. Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, has been giving evidence to police about alleged attempts to bring millions of dollars worth of jewellery into the country. And one of the world's biggest online criminal marketplaces, Genesis Market, has been taken down in an operation by police in 17 countries. Also in this podcast.
I honestly thought initially it was my water bottle leaking. And when I looked back down, I saw the head of the snake receding underneath the seat.
The unsettling realization at 3,000 meters up that there was a venomous snake on the plane. Democracy is under threat, a warning from the president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, as she met the U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on Wednesday in California. Ms. Tsai also said Taiwan was grateful that the United States was by its side.
It is no secret that today, the peace that we have maintained and the democracy which we have worked hard to build are facing unprecedented challenges. We once again find ourselves in a world where democracy is under threat. And the urgency of keeping the beacon of freedom shining cannot be understated.
Kevin McCarthy is the most high-profile American official to welcome a Taiwanese president on U.S. soil, and the meeting took place in defiance of threats from China. So how significant is this meeting? A question for our U.S. correspondent, David Willis.
Kevin McCarthy is the most senior American politician, Jackie, to meet a Taiwanese leader since 1979. And China doesn't like that one little bit. It regards Taiwan, of course, as part of China. And any dealings between Taiwan and the United States are seen as a challenge to China's claims of sovereignty. And this week, the Chinese leadership warned that the United States was playing with fire, as it put it, by engaging with President Tsai in this way, and it won't have liked the messaging that emerged from that meeting, the strong signs of support, with President Tsai saying that this visit was a sign that Taiwan wasn't isolated and was not alone, and Kevin McCarthy telling reporters that the two nations held a shared belief in democracy and freedom, and that their relationship was a matter of profound importance, as he put it, to the free world.
As you say, it was clear beforehand that the Chinese would see this as a provocation. So what was the US calculation here?
Well, the Biden administration is attempting to downplay this visit. It makes the point that the Taiwanese president is holding these meetings whilst in transit following a trip to Latin America, and that the meetings are quite normal, they're private and unofficial, and that, I have to say, hasn't assuaged China's suspicion, however, one little bit. And a short while ago, China's state media said that its vessels had launched a joint patrol an inspection operation in the Taiwan Straits.
So how would you characterise the current state of relations between Washington and Beijing?
Well, to put all this into context, it comes at a time when relations between the United States and China have reached probably their lowest point in decades. And also it comes amid growing international concern that China might perhaps be seeking to emulate Russia's move on Ukraine by attempting something similar itself with Taiwan. There is a lot of concern about that, hence President Tsai's comment that to preserve peace, we must be strong. I would add, she said, that we are stronger when we are together.
That was David Willis. The former Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro has been giving evidence to federal police in connection with a jewellery scandal. It concerns gifts which Mr. Bolsonaro and his wife received from Saudi Arabia back in 2021. Mr. Bolsonaro returned to Brazil last week from the US, where he spent 3 months in self-imposed exile following his defeat in the presidential election. Mr. Bolsonaro said that he didn't know about the existence of the items until December, a year after they entered the country. He added that he had made a concerted effort to avoid a diplomatic incident with Saudi Arabia, which could be offended if they found out that the gifts had been seized by customs. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, told us more about the scandal.
That was first broken by a newspaper in Brazil about a month ago, and it's been basically fascinating people in Brazil, the details of the jewellery, three lots of jewellery that each one is possibly worth $3 million, Rolex watches encrusted with diamonds, necklaces for the first lady. And what we had is like two lots of jewellery that President Bolsonaro or someone close to him managed to bring into the country. And there was one lot that was in the rucksack of one of his ministers on a different trip. And that's the one that triggered the whole thing. Police, customs stopped him. And then he said, oh, this is for the first lady. That's the allegation. And basically they seized that. And then the whole investigation started. President Bolsonaro, he says he hasn't done anything wrong.
There are separate investigations into his conduct in the run-up to the election and afterwards, aren't there?
There are many investigations. The two most serious, I mean, this might get him into trouble if he can't prove, but it's not as serious as the others. There are two serious investigations. One is that he was behind the attacks against the Congress building and presidential palace on the 8th of January in Brazil. So that would be very serious. That could lead him to serious trouble. And the other one would be the production of fake news against the Supreme Court calling for a military coup. That's been going on for a while.
He's always been a very divisive character, hasn't he? How is his popularity looking in the country right now?
Amazingly, it's stable. He was away, and of course, the new government is struggling to implement its measures. The government, the left-wing government of President Lula. So I think President Bolsonaro himself, he doesn't want to come back and run for election, but maybe one of his children who are politicians might do it. So the Bolsonaro legacy might live on. And I'm sure with this trial, there will be parallels that they will make with the Trump trial in the US, saying they are victims of a justice system that goes against them.
Leonardo Rocha. Four young children have been killed in an attack on a nursery school in the south of Brazil. Four others were injured and are in a stable condition. President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva called the attack in the city of Blumenau a monstrosity. Camila Mota reports from Sao Paulo.
According to the police, Luiz Henrique de Lima climbed the school's walls and attacked children playing in an outdoor area. He hit the infants in the neck with a hatchet. The victims were aged 4 to 7 years old. In a press conference, local authorities said Mr. Lima had a criminal record with at least 4 different offenses. He had been arrested in the past in possession of cocaine, had assaulted a man in a bar, stabbed his stepfather, and hurt a dog with a knife. Now he'll be charged with murder and attempted murder.
Camila Mota reporting. Cybercrime is a big problem around the world. Every minute of the day, millions of people are logging on to their bank accounts or shopping online, but lurking in the background can be a network of criminals ready to steal IDs and passwords. Now, one of the world's biggest criminal marketplaces used by online fraudsters to buy passwords has been closed down in a global law enforcement crackdown. Genesis Market sold login details, IP addresses, and other data that made up victims' so-called digital fingerprints. In Operation Cookie Monster, law enforcement agencies from 17 countries worked together to carry out 200 searches and made 120 arrests. Rob Jones is a senior official from Britain's National Crime Agency, and he says the operation should send a strong message to cybercriminals.
For too long, criminals have stolen credentials from innocent members of the public. We now want criminals to be afraid that we have their credentials, and they should be.
Our correspondent Daniel Sanford has been explaining how this marketplace worked.
Genesis Market was a website, and it wasn't on the dark web. It was on the normal open web. And if you were sent an invite to it by a criminal friend or criminal accomplice, that would give you an opportunity to log in. And there you would see the lists of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people's digital identities. So their login details, passwords, and then a whole load of other information which would help you to impersonate them online. So, for example, information about their browser, about the IP address they regularly used, about their physical location, which meant that if you had that information and you logged in using that information, as far as the bank or the shopping service was concerned, you were that person. You weren't somebody who had their login. You were actually that person. And these details, depending on how fulsome they were and how detailed they were, could sell for hundreds of dollars. But sometimes if it was one single login, it would just sell for a dollar on the website. So basically, it was hackers buying information in a giant sort of shopping list of people's digital identities.
And would everybody whose details were on there, would they know, or could they still be oblivious?
No, I mean, most people would have absolutely no idea that their digital identities were for sale on Genesis Market. There is now a way of checking that. The Dutch police have set up a portal on their website which you can put in your email or emails, and it will email you back if you're somebody whose data was for sale on there. But many people who've been hacked or had incorrect transactions happening on their kind of bank accounts or shopping accounts, even now, they won't know how someone got hold of that information. It may have been bought on Genesis Market, or it might have been bought on some of the other portals which still exist, some of them on the dark web.
So tell us about the operation to close it down, because this was a big deal, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, this was probably the most notorious and biggest of the really open websites selling financial information. And eventually, Dutch police and the FBI in the United States got together to shut it down. And then through the FBI working with their Five Eyes alliance, so Canada, Australia, New Zealand and the UK, and the Dutch working with their European allies through Europol, they got 17 different countries together. There's been arrests. About 120 people have been arrested across all of those countries. And the FBI have put a notice up on the Genesis Market website. If you try and go there today, it actually says this website's been seized, Operation Cookie Monster, and that's the name of the policing operation, which is a reference to the fact that one of the things you could buy on this website was people's cookies, which would again make shopping websites think that you were the original user and not the hacker.
How big is the international operation generally to try and keep a lid on cybercrime? How much cooperation is there?
Well, I think the answer is that they've been behind the curve and they've been pretty slow. I think there's been a recognition now that because people do so much of their lives online, whether it's their Netflix account for entertainment, PayPal accounts for paying, Amazon accounts for shopping, there's so much of what people are doing is either on their laptops or on their smartphones and tablets that there is a feeling that not enough has been done internationally. So people are starting to cooperate more and to realise that if they don't do that, then it's going to become a pretty ungoverned space.
Daniel Sanford. A new medical trial is underway for people suffering from progressive multiple sclerosis. MS is caused by the immune system attacking the brain and nerves, and there's no cure. It's 2 to 3 times more common in women than in men, and is usually diagnosed between the ages of 20 and 40, although it can develop at any age. The BBC's Caroline Wyatt, who has MS herself, met one of the first patients in the new trial.
Come on, babe. Yeah. Here, when you come.
Well,
we're
going to
play
or not?
Here, Winnie.
Ailsa Geedy and her husband Robert have been together since they studied at Manchester University. In 1997, Ailsa's eyesight became blurred when she took exercise, the first worrying sign of what was to come. 2 years later, a neurologist gave her a life-changing diagnosis.
Who said, you've got very mild MS. And at the time, my eyes filled up with tears. And he said, why are you crying? I was like, because you've just told me I've got MS. But he said, it's because it's very mild. But for me, I was like, I'm 24 and lots of my friends are in the pub. Obviously, relatively, from the neurologist's point of view, it wasn't as bad as it could be. But for me, it was not a good thing to be told.
Last year, Ailsa was told that her MS had moved from relapsing remitting, which is a stage when symptoms come and go, into secondary progressive, with more permanent disability. She didn't qualify for the one drug that might help.
That's great.
And so let's have a look at some coordination. With your left index finger, touch my left index. Let's start with the left one.
Let's start with my best.
Yeah, touch it there and touch your nose. Go backwards. And...
So now, Elsa's one of the first patients to join the new drugs trial that Professor Jeremy Chataway is leading at the National Hospital of Neurology and Neurosurgery in London. The trial's being called Octopus because it has several arms, meaning it can test more than one drug at a time against a single placebo. That design was first used in prostate cancer here, and then the race to find treatments for COVID-19.
In multiple sclerosis, particularly progressive multiple sclerosis, there's a limitation in terms of the current treatments available. And what we need to do is to get hold of medications that can protect the nervous system and ultimately repair and remyelinate the nervous system. That's the goal.
The first two medications are high-dose metformin, a diabetes drug that may help regenerate myelin in people who have MS. The other is a version of high-dose alpha-lipoic acid, a food supplement that's been approved in Germany for treating neuropathy, the weakness, pain or numbness caused by damaged nerves. The MS Society is giving £13 million of funding for the trial, as its Assistant Director of Research, Emma Gray, explains.
So this is going to be a multi-arm, multi-stage trial, and it's been used really successfully in COVID and in cancer studies. And it speeds up how quickly we can test treatments, and we thought this might be fantastic to trial in people with progressive forms of MS, where there hasn't been as much progress, and it enables us to run several treatments at once, but also combine the trial stages, making it much more efficient way of running it, and also cheaper.
You know, it's all anonymised. You've given a code number here. So yeah. Here is your medication and your code.
Thank you very
and we'll
much.
We'll go from there.
After a brain scan and several other tests, Elsa receives her first dose of medication. What she doesn't know is whether she's on a placebo or one of the first two trial drugs.
I hope that when I'm on the trial, it will keep me where I am, because that would be fine. You know, I've got difficulties walking and things like that, but I can cope with those. And I can live with it. I don't want it to get any worse.
So for Elsa and her family, it's well worth taking part, if only for the hope that the Octopus trial offers, as it opens 30 sites recruiting across the UK.
That report by my colleague Caroline Wyatt, who herself has multiple sclerosis. Still to come...
Great frozen cobwebs in the garden. Tonight's Salopian tipple is Shropshire Lady. At last... the hyacinths.
One of the world's oldest libraries, the Bodleian in Oxford, will now be archiving tweets, the online variety. We'll be back right after this.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service that seeks out extraordinary stories from around the globe.
I'm in a trench in Ukraine with shells flying overhead. Petrified.
It's a window into other people's worlds.
It can't be separated from the addictive nature of my personality.
And it's available now.
Feeling incredibly alive when death was at its closest.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. President Zelensky has thanked Polish companies which have continued operating in Ukraine since Russia's invasion. He was speaking during a visit to Warsaw, where Poland promised to send more fighter jets to the Ukrainian Air Force. Here's our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford.
Poland's support has been vital to Ukraine ever since Russia's invasion. It is the route in for Western tanks and weapons, and it's been the route out for millions of Ukrainian refugees. So Volodymyr Zelensky's first formal trip to Warsaw, met there by a military band, was to say thanks for not abandoning Ukraine, as he put it, but instead standing with Kyiv shoulder to shoulder.
Despite any threats, despite the circumstances at the time of the Russian aggression, to all those who believe in our country and believe not only in the future but in our present, I want to thank you and applaud you. Thank you very much.
Poland's president called his guest a unique man with a unique mission, which he described as saving Ukraine and Europe from Russian aggression.
I'm glad, Mr. President, that we can welcome you here in Warsaw today. We hope that there will be no physical border between Poland and Ukraine after this war, and that people who are going from Ukraine to Poland and from Poland to Ukraine won't even be able to see where this border used to be.
Poland was the first to send battle tanks to Ukraine, then MiG fighter jets, and is pledging more as officials in Kyiv talk of preparations for a renewed military offensive in the east. There, the long and brutal battle for Bakhmut goes on. And in Warsaw today, Volodymyr Zelensky admitted the situation was extremely tough. But he denied Russian claims that its forces are in control. In Poland, there is still overwhelming support for Ukraine, both from the public and the government. But in rural regions, there are growing complaints that a surge in Ukrainian imports is forcing down local grain prices. And today, that dispute led Poland's agriculture minister to resign.
Sarah Rainsford. Around the world, senior politicians found themselves under scrutiny and under pressure over how they dealt with the COVID-19 pandemic. On Wednesday, Fadil Novalic, who leads one of Bosnia's two regions, was sentenced to 4 years in prison in a case involving the purchase of Chinese ventilators in the early days of the pandemic. The government had bought 100 ventilators through a company that usually specialises in fruit and vegetable preservation. And the devices turned out to be unsuitable for use with seriously ill patients. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay began by explaining what exactly Fadil Novalic was convicted of.
Convicted of abuse of office, so that he overstepped the mark in terms of influencing the procurement process, so that it was won by this company called, of all things, Silver Raspberry, who, as the name implies, have got nothing to do with medical equipment, but are in fact a fruit processing company who previously had absolutely no experience whatsoever in procuring medical equipment. And they were chosen to source these medical respirators at the start of the COVID pandemic. And as you say, when they eventually arrived after this controversial process, which cost the people of Bosnia more than 5 million euros, these things didn't work.
He wasn't the only one involved, was he?
No, he wasn't. There were other people who were found guilty as well. Two other people, Fahruddin Salak, who was an official in charge of procuring equipment to combat the pandemic, and Fikret Hodzic, who was the manager of this very same Silver Raspberry company. They have also been given jail sentences for their part in the affair. One person was acquitted of all charges. That's the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina Finance Minister Jelka Milicevic.
Now, Fadil Novalic can appeal, can't he? But what are the likely political consequences of this sentencing?
Well, it's been a very political case, and straight away we've seen Mr. Novalic's party, the SDA, which is the largest party of Bosniak Muslims, saying that the case was politically motivated, that a senior Bosniak Muslim person has been deliberately targeted in this case, and that basically they're saying that it's all a stitch-up, and they expect it to be overturned on appeal. The interesting thing is that Mr. Novalic is actually able to stay in office as the Prime Minister of the Federation of Bosnia and Herzegovina. And he could be in that post still for some time because there have been all sorts of shenanigans in terms of forming the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina in the Federation region following last year's elections. And it's further worth noting that they haven't really had a functional government there since 2018. So it's adding to all of the turmoil they have in terms of governing that particular part of the country.
That was Guy Delaunay. Now to a story that's been making the headlines across Spain and beyond. A bitter debate has been taking place since a 68-year-old actress, Ana Obregón, said she'd had a baby by surrogacy in the US. The practice is illegal if carried out in Spain. Now in an interview with a Spanish magazine, she said that the baby girl is in fact her granddaughter. To unpick the story, we heard from our reporter Guy Hedgeko in Madrid.
What we've found out, in light of the latest revelations, is that she is the biological grandmother of this child, that the father of this baby is Ana Obregón's own son, Alessandro, who died 3 years ago after a battle with cancer at the age of 27. She says that he told her on his deathbed that he wanted to have a child live on after him, after his death. And so Ana Obregón says that she, in having this child via surrogacy, she is fulfilling the dying wish of her son who died 3 years ago. And the biological mother, as far as we know, is an American woman of Cuban descent who lives in Florida.
The legal picture is quite complicated, isn't it? Because having a woman give birth on your behalf is illegal in Spain, but adopting a child born abroad is lawful. But there are further complications as a grandparent, is that right?
It is a very tricky legal area, this. Spain civil code does say that you're not allowed to adopt a direct descendant. Now, Ana Obregón says that she is doing this all legally because she is legally the baby's mother, even though biologically she is the grandmother. Also, I think you have to take into account the fact that this process has taken place in the United States and not in Spain. So the surrogacy itself, that was allowed to happen because it took place in the United States where this is legal. At the moment, what she has said is that this is absolutely above and beyond any reproach legally. But there has been a lot of debate.
Yes, the government has condemned her, hasn't it? What sort of other reactions have there been?
Yes, I mean, we've heard from the Equality Minister, Irene Montero, for example, in the leftist government, said that surrogacy is a form of violence against women. And we've heard very similar comments by other ministers in the government. I mean, we've heard from, for example, the opposition, the main opposition Popular Party, which is a Conservative Party. They've taken a slightly more nuanced approach. They say this is a complex subject. It requires a deep debate and it's something which needs to be discussed publicly and over time.
Guy Hedgeco in Spain. One of the world's oldest and most famous libraries, the Bodleian in the English city of Oxford, will now be archiving tweets. It's starting with three accounts, including that of the British historian Mary Beard. She gave an example of one of her tweets with added sound effects.
Great frozen cobwebs in the garden. Tonight's Salopian tipple is Shropshire Lady. At last, the hyacinths. The holly tree next door is looking great. The turkey's being cooked according to Katie Stewart's Times cookery book, Kirker 1972.
The Bodleian, guardian of some of the world's rarest books and manuscripts, obviously thinks public opinion, as featured on Twitter, is of historic importance. But why? Paul Henley spoke to Susan Thomas, head of archives at the library.
So much of ordinary life and exceptional events in our lives play out on Twitter, and it's really inconceivable that we might have an archive that documents the 21st century without Twitter.
But how are you going to choose what to conserve, or does it all go in the archive? That can't be feasible.
I think we're not looking at a comprehensive archive, and we're also looking at a distributed archive. So the Bodleian Libraries are not the only library to collect Twitter, and more and more libraries I think will be in the future. So I think it's looking at the kinds of individuals who have an impact, looking at ordinary individuals, but also looking at events. And I think Twitter is very interesting for the way we see sort of things like citizen journalism popping up. We see instant response to events on the ground being reflected in Twitter. So it's a really good sort of way of capturing immediate responses.
Prominent historians have long said, haven't they, that trivial notes from history steered them in interesting directions.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think it connects us with people as human beings as well. I mean, we tend to put historical figures on pedestals, don't we? But they are people like the rest of us. I think we were talking with Mary Beard earlier about her Twitter account and how it sort of talks about her making the Christmas dinner, the turkey and all the rest of it. And I think those are sorts of things that we want to know about people. It's instinctive, really. It's a human connection, isn't it?
How will users of the library access this feature?
Well, I think that's going to evolve. To start with, I think we'll be looking at public access for public data, but we're also conscious that there's private data in full Twitter accounts, and that kind of content might not be suitable for access immediately in a public kind of way, so that might need a bit more mediation.
And will there be the proviso when people access it that this is an archive of opinion and not necessarily a fact?
I think it's always important to approach archives of any medium whatsoever with that in mind, really, to kind of question the sources that you're exploring and look at them with a very critical lens and ask questions of them and consider their reliability.
Should all social media users, do you think, be archiving their tweets as a matter of course?
For some people, Twitter is a really important part of their life and potentially their personal history and a piece of their family history they might want to hand on to their children and their children's children. So I think that's certainly something that people want to have a think about. And not just Twitter either. I mean, people who are intensive users of things like Instagram, great collections of family photos that might have been stored in a shoebox or two in the attic in years gone by, are now in sort of social media spaces on cloud storage. So that these are things that people really need to think about if they value those things.
Oh, sorry, I was just archiving my cat tweets. That was Susan Thomas, head of archives at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Now, a warning for those of you who are afraid of snakes or have a fear of flying. This next story involves a small plane and a highly venomous Cape Cobra snake. Rudolph Erasmus was flying four passengers from South Africa's Western Cape to the northeast of the country. The journey was uneventful. They were cruising at around 3,000 metres. Then, as he told Audrey Brown, he felt something against his hip.
I honestly thought initially it was my water bottle leaking. And when I looked back down, I saw the head of the snake receding underneath the seat. But my brain didn't register immediately what was going on. So I couldn't see the colouring that great, but I could see its tongue flickering about as it went down underneath. So I informed the passengers that, listen, we've got a bit of a situation on board. The snake is underneath my seat. So we're going to have to try and get the aircraft back on the ground as soon as we can. Luckily, I must say, all of the passengers were quite calm as well. Luckily, no one was panicking with fear.
And how long would you have had to live with a snake under your seat?
To be truly honest, I really can't remember the amount of time it took. It felt like an eternity, but it was probably something like 10 minutes or 15 minutes at most.
That's a very long 15 minutes, right?
100%.
Were you scared, though, at any point that the snake might come out and get aggravated or annoyed and harm you, bite you?
It was definitely an idea that I had in my head, but I was mainly concerned just getting the aircraft back down on the ground as safely and quickly as possible.
Is this the closest you've ever been to a snake?
I think so, yeah. Most definitely a venomous snake. But we faced another challenge. As we got out of the aircraft, I saw it was curled up underneath my seat. And eventually when the snake catchers did arrive to try and remove the snake from the aircraft, it had completely disappeared.
Oh, no. Where had it gone?
It either went back down through the rudder pedals or from one of the vents.
And we will never know. The pilot, Rudolph Erasmus, who has been praised as a hero for his bravery and skill in landing the plane safe. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics we covered, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
When your business travel is out of balance, you feel it. At National Car Rental, you're in control. Skip the counter, choose any car in the aisle, and manage your rental right from the app, so you can balance the boardroom with the not-so-board. Climb rocks after you rock your presentation, and mix work with leisure, or leisure with work. Find the perfect balance with National Car Rental. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.